Hey everyone, I'm Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
And I'm Roger, a student at King's College London.
And this is That Medic Podcast.
In this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking to Dr. Anna Snader, the co-founder and CEO of Patchwork Health, a startup revolutionizing flexible working within healthcare. In this podcast, we discuss his journey into clinical entrepreneurship, the importance of mentorship, and how to go about testing your minimum viable product. So, without further ado, let's have a listen to this episode. Anas, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being on That Medic Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me over. Really pleased to be here today and looking forward to the
Fantastic.
Chat.
Fantastic. So, look, Anas, you know, we normally start these shows by sort of asking the question, why did you decide to sort of study medicine in the first place?
So, I have to take a few years back now, almost back to when I was 18 years old. I didn't take a traditional route to medicine. I did a graduate entry program here in the UK at Imperial College London, the four-year program, when it used to be 4 years before they made it five. And like most, like all grad entry medical students, we had another career prior to medicine, or at least another degree, some of us a degree and a career. And I was one of those medical students who took that, what back then was an unorthodox path. So in my undergrad, prior to studying medicine, back in Toronto, Canada, where I'm from originally, I studied human physiology and political science. And for me, I did that out of pure interest. I was always fascinated by the human physiology, human anatomy, and how the human body functions from a very basic science point of view, not from a clinical point of view yet. And I was really into world affairs, international affairs, and was an avid reader of history books. So really wanted to do something that was in the humanities area. So once I've graduated my undergrad and my BSc, I always had back my mind potentially becoming a doctor, something that I've considered in the past when I was younger, but wasn't ready to make that leap yet. Now, worth mentioning that as a teenager up until that first degree, I was also a self-taught coder. I was a hobbyist, learning how to write code, really amateur, but still got myself into coding for desktop before even web was something back in the 90s, before I got into web coding. And that combination of knowledge of human physiology and biology and knowing how to write code got me into a few fun small jobs in hospitals in Toronto, where I was building websites for patient education, student education, clinical content, the kind of simple websites that really delivered value for hospitals that back then wanted to get into the world of putting some of their content on the web. So that was a lot of fun. And I realized that I actually loved doing that. So I did a master's taking my amateur product development and writing code into a slightly more professional world. So I did that master's back in Toronto again, and I continued to work into my late 20s in this space. I was a freelancer. I was most of the time, but I also worked with agencies and companies at times to work in that space of building web products, simple websites for hospitals and clinics. Now, obviously, in that role, I continued to work with clinicians and patients and hospital managers. So my interest in pursuing a career as a doctor never really died. And I got to my late 20s when I decided that I actually will regret not doing it if I don't just make the leap now. So I was reinventing myself, deciding to go back to uni. I also wanted to travel. I wanted to studying. I didn't want to go for a third degree back in the same city that I grew up in. Yeah. So I decided to apply to Imperial College, and I was very happy that I was accepted. Moved to London in 2009, started my medical training, and did the four-year graduate entry program. So So really, for me, that journey was never a straight line. Yeah. And I think I look back at that and I say every single step along the way in that decade between being, you know, graduating from high school all the way to getting to medical school, that decade was quite critical in shaping my identity, shaping my who I was going to be in the future beyond my career in medicine.
Fantastic. So like you had coding on one side and you had like human physiology. They seem like two ends of the different spectrum. So what drew your interest towards coding in the first place? Did you see there was a role for it at all? Was it something that your friends were exploring, or how did you sort of get involved with it?
So I think my love for medicine and human physiology as well as coding stemmed from a very similar personality trait that I had when I was young. And that is that kind of curiosity to know how things work. So I remember when my dad bought our first PC, and that was back when there was MS-DOS and Windows 3.1.
Yeah, yeah.
Most of your audience probably would not even recognize what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a world where we had floppy disks, and we were the big floppy disks.
Even I remember ones, those. I do remember the floppy disks. Yeah, yeah. My dad had those. Yeah. I remember those.
Yeah. So as soon as we started bringing that, kind of, we started buying software, we started installing that software. And I was like looking at that, the programs that were on that PC, and asking myself, someone had to write that code. Someone had to build it. How does this even machine work? How do these apps even exist, and how did they work? And I just wanted to learn how to tinker with it. And I think it's the same curiosity of just wanting to know how things work. I always got frustrated not knowing how the human body works and how to fix it, and similarly how software works and how to fix it. And that attracted me to both worlds. And I think that's probably one of the areas I'm very grateful for, obviously my parents and my teachers when I was younger, who have just always made sure that they nourished that curiosity to explore the things that I want to explore or learn how things worked, regardless of where it took me. Sometimes it took me to a career path. Other times it just became a hobby. But I think that's where that comes from because they're very different universes. Now, obviously, the advantage of being generally someone who has a strong science background is you'll find that some of the analytical skills that comes with being a scientist feed really well into being a coder, a clinician, and really anything else that I've done since, including entrepreneurship. So at the end of the day, if you break into its fundamental blocks, there's a lot more similarities in these in the disciplines.
Fantastic. So before you go into that entrepreneurship journey you've had, and also sort of some of the things you've been working on before, patchwork, which we'll go to a bit later, how did that coding ability sort of change the way you approach medicine at all? Like your mindset? And it must have been a sort of unique skill when you came to medical school. Did it change your approach at all in any sort of way? Or
I guess it made me always want to question why things have been done the way they're done. And I've always been curious to understand why guidelines have been created the way they've been created and what was the thinking behind them. I've always got involved, even as a junior doctor, since I was in F1, I was involved in projects to improve processes within wards and departments, just because, again, I just wanted to know how things were designed the way they were designed and question why they were designed that way and see if they can be improved on. So I guess it just made me take things, it made me just not take things for granted, not assume that just because it's been done that way, it's always the right way to do things. And made me want to see if we can tinker with our processes. So I think that, however, just to make sure that it doesn't sound like there's a rosy story, it turned me to a very frustrating doctor. Because that kind of personality trait has its downside, because often it means that you're the kind of person who's always saying, but why, but why, but why, both when I was young and knowing to my parents and as a doctor in the hospital.
That's drove me crazy.
and you just end up being a bit frustrated because often people either don't know why or it's very hard to change. And that actually really has been one of the reasons why I stepped away from full-time medical work, because I was facing all these frustrations of feeling things didn't always make sense why we did them the way we did them, but it was very hard to change from within.
So it's interesting. I'm sure I understand how your mind works, but it's, you know, you love thinking about how things work the way they do, why things work the way they do. Enjoy sort of problem solving as well, I can sort of tell. And looking at processes, is that what entrepreneurship is all about then? This is now I can sort of tell why you've explored that. Is that what entrepreneurship is, I suppose?
Oh, absolutely. I think entrepreneurs are at the heart of what they do are problem solvers. They've identified the problem, either they've experienced or witnessed, and felt that things can be done a better way, and decided not to fall into the trap of, well, it's always been done that way, and decide to question. So I think entrepreneurship is about being able to question the status quo and being willing to roll up your sleeves and problem solve. And actually, I think, generally speaking, doctors are in many ways indirectly trained to be good entrepreneurs. Because if you think about medical training, they train us in good communication skills, being able to handle bad news or break bad news, which often is quite a lot of it in entrepreneurship, being able to absorb a lot of information from different sources. Some sources are more objective than others, whether it's a history taking, which is subjective at times, and or a blood test, which is objective, and then digest that information at pace and come up with the best treatment plan you can think of that might not be always the right treatment plan, and then iterate on that plan if the results are not heading in the right direction. So in the world of entrepreneurship, iterate on your project, on your innovation until you get it right. And being willing to work weekends and nights, I guess. So if you combine all of that,
it's a natural,
It's a natural, and I think that's something that I hadn't realized until I became an entrepreneur, that having gone through the medical training, I probably was better prepared to be an entrepreneur. Because I've been asked in the past by family and friends, could you have just moved from your previous training prior to medicine and jumped over that medical school step and gone straight to tech entrepreneurship? And I'd actually argue that I don't think it would have worked out that way, because I'm very grateful for the medical training I received. And because I think it made me a better entrepreneur. And in general, I never believe that you can skip any step from your past. Every single one of those steps were very relevant to who you are today, the good and the bad, the ups and the downs. So yeah, anyway, so I think genuinely, I think it's a very interesting. So to go back to your question, what is entrepreneurship in that sense? Is that the definition of entrepreneurship? I wholeheartedly believe that entrepreneurship is not often a choice. I often find medical students coming to me and saying, what is the next problem we should be looking to solve? And I say that's you're coming at it from the wrong way, the problem finds you, the idea finds you. You don't find the idea. Just be prepared for when the idea finds you that you're ready to do something about it.
That's really interesting. I think I do agree as well. So the talks I've had as well, a lot of entrepreneurships do agree that it's finding that problem. You know, whether you're on the wars, whether it's someone you know of, you know, those sort of issues that you need to sort of be identifying and then addressing, and that's how you can sort of solve a problem quite more simply.
Correct.
So on your sort of entrepreneurship journey, of course, you've been involved with quite a few projects, and one project I'm quite interested to sort of understand and learn more about is the sort of ECG Made Easy project that you're involved with, I think quite a few years back.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering about, I don't need to go sort of too much detail about the project itself, but it's really about the lessons you've learned and how that sort of shapes you and your approach going forward, I suppose.
That project has a special place in my heart. That I owe a lot to that project for the world. It's paved in front of me after that. So easymadesimple.com is, and right now it's really did not age well. It's been a website that hasn't been really updated for a while now since I've handed over to a different team. But it's a project that I worked with my first mentor, Dr. Luigi Casella, who is a cardiologist, a retired cardiologist. Well, when I met him in the early 2000s, when I was in my undergrad at the University of Toronto, he was a cardiologist at one of the hospitals attached to the University of Toronto. And he, I was doing, I think, a project in the hospital, part of my degree. He heard that I'm an amateur coder, and he reached out to me and said, listen, I'm nearing retirement. I've developed a methodology in teaching medical students and nursing students and even trainees how to interpret ECGs. That methodology has won him awards. He didn't tell me that, by the way. I found out later on that he's a big shot. He's won awards. There's actually an award in education at the University of Toronto named after him called the Luigi Casella Award for Education. Wow. But he himself won international awards for his unique style of teaching ECGs and allowing students to picture the heart in 3D methods and really walking through the electrophysiology of the heart and getting better at pattern recognition of ECG. So he was just quite a special educator. And he said, I would like to capture all of my knowledge and my experience as my kind of parting gift as I retire into an online platform to teach medical students for years to come. So I was very honored that he said, and he said, listen, I've got no money. I've got no funding. I'm not gonna be paid for this. Are you willing to jump in? I'm like, hell yeah, let's do it. And obviously, at that point, this is a good example of say yes and then figure it out later. Because I had no idea how to do what he wanted me to do.
So why did you... interrupt you. But you know, a lot of students are very much like... I had the same approach to you. But a lot of students are like, I want to earn some money. I want to, you know... So why did you take that, knowing it's not paid? It's not, you know... Why did you do it?
I guess because... At the heart of it, first of all, it was one summer. Eventually, we got grants to pay for our time. So it remained a nonprofit project, just paid for my time and some of his time and other people's time through grants. But that summer, it was completely free. Mm. And to me, it I guess what really excited me is I valued the opportunity to work with an incredible mind like his, to do something that I've never done before, and to learn on the job and then see where it goes. And I think that was just enough for me to say, I'm willing to put in a couple of days a week for a summer and just see where it goes. I would have done it for years without being paid because someone has to pay the bills. And luckily I was an undergrad, so I had student loans that carried me through that summer. And I know that's not always, I recognize the privilege I had to be able to have student loans, but to me, it was that opportunity to work with an incredible person and do something I've never been paid to do. So I didn't feel confident to ask to be paid for it. But again, I think to go back to one of the early personality traits I had, for better or worse, was being the kind of guy who says yes and then tries to figure it out later on. I mean, again, that doesn't always work out in a positive way, but in that specific scenario, it was the best thing I've done because basically he wanted me to create online animations of the human heart, the human heart.
Yeah, yeah.
And animate the electrophysiology of the human heart and trace it on the ECG. Why would a wave come down the atrium create a P wave, and why would the QRS complex is created the way it's created? How is that related to how the electrical waves travel down the ventricles and back up to the edges of the ventricles in a 3D manner? And then talking about all the blocks and the types of blocks and types of arrhythmias and the bypasses. And I'm like, how do I visualize that? So luckily back then there was a technology called Flash, which doesn't exist anymore. and I had to learn ActionScript 3, which is a way to code into Flash animations. And I pretty much bought the books I need to buy. Again, early 2000s, no YouTube to teach you. You had to actually buy books to learn how to code. And I built it. And he was so happy with the initial prototype of the first few tutorials. And then quickly we moved into a website. And, you know, just fast forwarding quickly, because that I can spend hours talking about that project.
So how old was you then?
How old was I? I was 19, 20.
Wow.
When I first started. Yeah.
Wow.
I was doing my first degree before I did my master's. In fact, he introduced me to the master's program. He's like, did you hear about this master's program if you want to take it to the next step? And he sponsored me in the reference forms. What excited me with that project is it allowed me to be the reason why he was an excellent mentor, and I owed a lot to Dr. Casella, is firstly, he gave me the safety to fail. He was very much so happy for us to keep doing it again and again until we got right. And that meant that I could take the first step and knowing that if I get it wrong, it's okay. Because I guess the hardest thing is to always be expected to get it right when you have no experience and then where you start. The second one is that he was always pushing me to be a better version of myself. So he would, he was very good at giving the kind of constructive feedback that does not affect one's confidence, but still makes one want to be a better version of themselves. So that was a very, very positive experience. And I say it shaped me because it shaped me into someone who believes in the power of technology and the web, but also in the importance of mentorship and strong relationships and role models in your life, and to learn how I can one day be myself a good leader, allowing people to fail and giving people the support they need to be better versions of themselves. So it was an instrumental period of my life. And the beauty of it, by the way, the product was nonprofit, so it was free to access. Anyone can access for free. We end up getting 60,000 medical students around the world signing up over 5 years program.
Wow.
The best part of that is more than half is from the Southern Hemisphere. Basically, more than half are from countries where medical education is not similar to what we experience in the Northern Hemisphere.
Wow.
So whether it's with Sub-Saharan Africa, East Africa, South Africa, South Asia, South America, 50% of that 60,000 users were from medical students who wouldn't have dreamt to have been taught by someone as world-renowned as Dr. Casella. And that, to me, is why I connected the dots of the power of the web. The fact that someone like him, in his last few years, in his 80s, was managed to work with me to build a platform that educated 60,000 medical students around the world is just incredible.
Hmm.
At literally minimal cost. Minimal cost for us, and for the world is for free. Yeah.
I would say at such a young age as well, 19, 20 years old, I just think it's so inspiring.
Yeah.
And the reason is, well, first of all, that's just incredible. But I think one of the reasons it's so interesting to learn about this stuff and hear about it, if the students are listening, it's one of the main takeaways is that, you know, we're still young at 19, 20, whatever, but there's so many things we can get involved with. And the reason I actually set up this network in the first place is to really inspire students and get students involved with these opportunities. Because I'm not saying it's, you know, you're going to be, you know, educating, you know, 30,000, you know, students across Sub-Saharan Africa, say, but it's, you can have an impact, and even a small impact. But look at what's happened here. You know, this mentor's not only helped you sort of learn a few things about yourself, but also has put you on the right path in terms of, you know, the master's program and giving you some guidance, which I'm sure just sort of giving you sort of direction in the future in running your own startup now. So I think this is the stage from my own small experiences what I've had, and clearly as you just discussed, Anas, this is the stage to get involved with things and to get involved with these opportunities. And to get mentors and to learn and make mistakes and fail, because there's nothing wrong with it, you know? And I'm sure those sort of the things that you should discuss has shaped you as an individual and how you've approached in running your own company today, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
Fantastic. Well, like now, you know, moving on to into sort of what you're working on now, you know, you are now the CEO and co-founder of Patchwork, which is of course addressing the workforce crisis. But I was wondering if you could go into detail about what the crisis, how you can across it, I suppose, this issue, and where it all sort of started.
I mean, I'll take a step back of what got me to think about workforce in general. So back to being, when I was graduating from medical school, I worked as a junior doctor for a few years. And as a junior doctor, what I have faced quite quickly is the realization that everything else about me had to be put on pause. That the rigidity of workforce management in healthcare, and that's just not in the NHS, it's healthcare as a whole, not just in the UK, meant that clinicians had to pretty much put everything else in their life on hold. I often find that it's quite symbolic that we, when we get to hospitals, we take off our clothes that make us unique and we all wear the same scrubs, which makes us look quite identical. I think it's a similar way of how workforce has been managed in healthcare for the most part. You come into the hospital, before you're in the hospital, you are a parent, you are looking after an elderly parent, you're a musician, you're an artist, you're a humanitarian, you're a world traveler, you're a coder, you're an innovator, you're a researcher, you're any of those. But once you become a full-time doctor, that's all you are. And your career doesn't give you the opportunity to be able to be the things that you are, that made who you are. And obviously, having gone through that journey I described to you earlier, having not been that traditional route into medicine, that was quite jarring for me. Now, this is, to be very clear, medicine, anyone who gets to any healthcare profession is obviously aware of the demands on your time this profession does have. But that also applies to many other professions outside of healthcare. Gilded, regulated professions in the world have a similar demand on the individual. However, what's unique about healthcare and how healthcare workforce is managed is the very little flexibility available for clinicians to choose a path that allows them to still balance their chosen career as doctors or nurses, as well as their personal and other professional interests. And that rigidity and difficulty in managing to tailor that world for myself was a cause of a lot of frustration. Now, what I realized is that I initially thought I was the odd one, but obviously I wasn't. Quite a lot of my colleagues were experiencing a similar sense of frustration. And when it starts coming into even getting to a point where it starts to impact one's mental health, you start noticing that symptoms of burnout. And burnout presents itself in different ways. Certainly physical burnout from physical long hours is one way, but often what most healthcare professionals experience is the burnout of their personal and social life and their identity. So it's not about the hours they're putting in necessarily. It's about what it takes away from their ability to do. So in one summer of 2016, I met with my old friend, Jing, who's my co-founder now, at a medtech conference in London. And we're both kind of having a cathartic conversation, venting about our experiences as junior doctors and wanting to take a step back. And of course, at that point, it was quite common for a lot of doctors to take a year out of training and to work as possibly locums, which is a word for temporary staff, and pursue other interests. So we were sharing notes about what could we do, who would you work with, which agency would you choose to work with? And obviously, that conversation led us to asking ourselves the question of, well, wouldn't it be nice not to have to work with a specific agency or a specific hospital and be able to just have a simpler way to access clinical work, a marketplace of clinical work where technology is doing the heavy lifting. But quickly, we shelved the idea because we thought that it's probably pretty difficult to build anything that requires that level of adoption in the NHS. And I guess the skeptic in us just felt like it's too big of a problem for two medics to solve. So we went off to our own years out of training. And my year, he did a fellowship up in Liverpool. And I did a fellowship at Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. It was a Darzi Fellowship, a clinical innovation and leadership fellowship that allowed me to take it was actually quite a forward thinking fellowship because it introduced doctors with management or innovation background. So the kind of medics who have something else to bring to the table other than being a doctor. They recruited five of us and they've embedded us with the operational team and the management team. We reported directly to the executive board of the hospital. And they wanted us to, each one of us, to be associated with different improvement projects to help the trust achieve some of its either quality goals or financial goals. I was assigned to a few projects. One of them happened to be looking at how the hospital can reduce its reliance on medical agencies and improve its recruitment of flexible workers directly on their staff bank, which was serendipity, if I've seen one. It was just perfect opportunity for me only a few months ago, questioning whether we can ever do something like this, to be told by a hospital, here's a problem, go solve it for us. Now, to be clear, it wasn't, they didn't task me to solve it technologically. They wanted me just to look at that problem and see what we could do. And obviously, initially, I did not jump into the technology approach. I wanted to understand the problem from the employer's point of view, because clearly the hospital gave me the signal that they have their hearts and minds in the right place. They believe, as an NHS employer, they need to do better at managing and recruiting and supporting flexible working for medics. And they knew not doing that means that you're going to lose medics and that you will be relying heavily on expensive agencies. They just didn't... Sorry, go ahead.
Out of interest, sorry. Was this a consensus, or was this something from the management at the top? Was this something that people were discussing in clinic about, oh, we need to be making this more flexible, or was it more
It's a universally agreed concept. I guess back then it was I would say there would be pockets of conversations in high executive leadership or certain operational and medical leadership within individual teams in the hospital. I wouldn't say the concept of flexible working being a default, being a priority, was as well discussed and appreciated in 2016 as it is today. But certainly, there were enough people thinking about it, yet not finding the best way to achieve it.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, you know, a big part of hopefully one of the takeaway messages from today is when I was saying earlier, the problems, the idea or the problem finds you, don't find it. To me, that was an excellent opportunity to understand the entirety of the challenge, because I understood it as a doctor, obviously being a lived experience. Now being embedded as an innovator or an improvement person who's working with the hospital execs to look at from the employer side, I understood exactly where the problem was on an operational level from the employer level, problems that us as medics will never see, whether it's compliance issues, payroll, payments, rates, decision making, who gets to book what shifts, and doing that for large volumes of shifts. We're talking about thousands of shifts a month. That is a challenge that us as medics might not see, that I had to understand. And by understanding that challenge and all the stakeholders involved in that, whether it's HR teams, payroll teams, operational teams, compliance teams, recruitment teams, clinical leadership teams, understanding all of that, their pain points and their experience with temporary staffing or flexible working, really gave me the appreciation to what technology can do in the space and where exactly you can solve the problem. And So what I did then is what I have always done, which is just go ahead and ask the question and see where it takes you. So I went ahead and to my boss back then, the chief operating officer, Rob Hotchkiss, and I told him, I think this is something my co-founder, well, my colleague and I back then, Jing, have been thinking about for a while. And now that I've seen it from the inside, I think we can do something together here. We can co-create a solution with the hospital. Help us de-risk it, help us test it and validate it, and we'll just work with the trust in bringing that solution to life. And I was very, again, lucky to have had a very receptive audience at the executive board who were very willing to jump and try something. I mean, I guess firstly because the solution they tried in the past didn't work. So I guess there was a true desire to think outside the box. But obviously, because I was already six months into that role, I've managed to build my credibility within the organization. And so much so that they're willing to start small, but take some risk with me. And that's where we decided to just go ahead and build a platform that works for both employers and workers, a clinician-facing platform, which allows them to be recruited into staff banks, self-manage their bookings, submit their timesheets, fully self-managed with autonomy. But from the employer side, create that platform that allows them to build a rules engine to decide what can be done and how, but also at scale so that they can manage the large volumes of work flexibly in a scalable manner and reduce their reliance on other options like agencies. And to our surprise, an MVP that we built within 6 months, and I say an MVP in every sense of that term, it was a tin can with duct tape that took us to the moon.
I'm like, how can you build it? Because it just sounds so complex. Like you talked about the challenges there. There are so many different challenges that you were facing with Reuters and the, you know, the number of things coming through, the payment, all of this was. So how can you build an MVP from that sort of, I suppose? It seems very complex.
Absolutely. And I think we didn't build everything. We didn't solve all problems. I think that's kind of a big and important message to all kind of product managers or innovators. And I've obviously learned from a lot of clever people who helped me along the way that you really need to identify the most important element of that pathway that you can bring value to as an innovator. So some problems are simple problems, or some problems are really not a problem. It just needs to be done. It's table stakes features that you have to develop at some point, but it's not where the challenge exists. And it's not the kind of thing that will bring that dramatic value to the user. Being able to identify what are the top three or five things that your product can do that will have a 10x effect on the pathway and the workflow is the most important thing to do. And again, luckily, being an insider who understood it from both sides of the marketplace, the clinician and the employer, I was able to, with my team, identify those very important things we had to get right. So there's a lot of things we did not get right with that MVP. And hence why, and that MVP is now more than 4 years old. And we've since then have iterated hundreds of times. And obviously there are still things we're still building. So you never stop building on the product. But we got enough things right early on to dramatically bring the fill rates from 30% to above 90% within 6 months. So more than 90% of all their vacancies were filled by bank. Their baseline was 30%. And their staff bank grew by about 500%. So that transition meant that we got enough things right to have validated that technology can enable flexible working, can allow it to do at scale while remaining compliant and with the right controls, meant that now we're onto something that we can use to go for a proper raise from a fundraising point of view, but also to take it outside of Chelsea and start implementing in other hospitals because we validated that our thinking around the product will bring a 10x value. But that's when the fun starts, but also that's when the challenges start, because now you're refactoring code, you're rebuilding it to make it more scalable across multiple trusts, you're fixing bugs, you're building beyond the MVP, you're bringing in the features you never built and start with because you're trying to just get the concept across. And now you have more stakeholders to manage and everything becomes 10x harder as well. So I think knowing exactly where are the areas you can bring the highest value early on and focusing on that first is my advice.
That's so brilliant. I think I can imagine how difficult integration is with all the different systems, but that's really fascinating. I also like the fact how you said you're validating the product. Like you spent a long time, say 6 months or so, just focusing on your initial product, making sure what the pain points were. And also, even before you approached it as well, to sort of recap, you know, you didn't go straight to technology, you went to the people. You know, who are the users? Who is using this stuff on a day-to-day basis? What are their experiences? You know, you mapped out the whole pathway and then you went in and then addressed it. And I just think that's fantastic. And one more thing I sort of add is, I thought it was an interesting thing you mentioned was that me as a future doctor, but you know, healthcare professionals, nurses, etc., these are the ones experiencing this thing, these issues, these challenges, because if positions aren't filled and they have to take the stresses of it, right? Even more burnout. Yet they're not the ones in control of the situation. And that's, I think, is really interesting. It's sort of out of their control. Only now you went in that sort of fellowship role that you were able to sort of address it. And it's a bit like, is there anything more that healthcare professionals can be doing to make these things come to light? I suppose just raising awareness about where the issues are, I suppose. But
that's a very good question. I think there's quite a lot of, I think the world has moved on to a much better place than when I was a fresh grad at med school. I think the NHS has gotten much better at giving opportunities for clinicians to take on leadership roles and enact impact and bring some impact, a positive impact. So fellowships like the one I've done, whilst back then it was new, now there's quite a lot of them out there. There are one of our partners, one of Patrick's partners, Medics Academy and the Healthcare Leadership Academy. They have their own program where they can support medical students and clinicians in getting involved in change. So I think wherever you are, whichever medical school you're graduating from, or whichever hospital you end up training at, if you ask around enough, you probably will find an opportunity to be involved in change. And I think it's very important for clinicians not to take a passive role and be just a passenger on that journey for the NHS, as the NHS goes through transformation, improvement, digitization, whatever that you're interested in. And it doesn't have to always be tech. A lot of improvement happens outside of tech. A lot of user experience is not the pixels on the screen. It's real life interactions you can improve on. So, but just get involved and look around, and you'll find that there are opportunities wherever you are to be involved one way or another. So luckily that has become much better. And I'm very optimistic about the future. So long that we remain as clinicians, as doctors, actively involved and seeking these opportunities. But to go back to kind of the point you're saying about really working with the end user, and I think that's another thing, another reflection, another area I'm really pleased about is the fact that some of the early decisions we've made in how we work with the NHS as innovation partners, the fact that we don't build tech in a basement and then parachute it into a hospital and then hope for the best. That early decision and the way we've collaborated with Chelsea and Westminster Hospital just became part of our DNA. Because whilst since then, we've moved on to work with over 25 NHS trusts and 70 hospitals and many GP practices, we still remained true to that value of working in partnership with our end users. So for example, you might be aware that since last year, we've expanded our product roadmap to go beyond temporary staffing and to go into all types of staffing, and to bring the concept of flexible working and clinician empowerment and modern scheduling to all types of scheduling, including substantive rostering. That meant another investment in building new tech and new solutions. But we did it the same way we did with Chelsea, this time with Imperial College NHS Trust and a few others, but led by Imperial College, our alma mater, which obviously has its own symbolism. But the same hospitals that Jing and I trained as medical students went back to through our work with them already on temporary staffing to co-create the next generation of substantive rostering for all clinicians, but primarily doctors. And since then, we've expanded that program to include 10 trusts. So we're calling it our accelerator program. It's our innovation accelerator program that basically brings 10 trusts to the table to co-create their next generation of rostering. And I am so proud of that program because it genuinely created the kind of space that the NHS needed to come together. And that was happening during COVID. So these sessions, these design sessions and sprints with many hospitals and stakeholders was happening all virtually, but it was a space for people to escape the stresses of the pandemic and day-to-day BAU work to come into a space and imagine a world where there is amazing innovation happening for better management of the future workforce, coming from hospitals across the country, from the northwest of England to all the way down to Surrey and everything in between, including many London trusts. And that was really, really exciting and remained the one of our biggest USPs is how we work with the end user to build products that truly were created with the user in mind because they were involved in that ideation phase and the problem solving phase. So, you know, my advice for any entrepreneur listening today or wannabe, in addition to hopefully having a lived experience with your idea, is really finding the right partnerships for innovation. Your right innovation partnerships, and if you're working within the NHS, that basically means NHS users, NHS managers, NHS partners who eventually become buyers of your solution. But by creating it with your end, your potential customers, you have de-risked massively your innovation cycle. You validated your assumptions. And you made sure that you're not just building something that will never be used, as sadly many IT projects in the NHS have in the past failed to deliver on the promise.
Fantastic. I think so. All I'd say is, you know, it's been a real honor to have you on the show. And what we normally do at the end of the show is sort of, you know, ask our guests for three pieces of advice or so, which I think you've sort of already covered. But if you have two, three pieces of advice in summary that you'd give to any, you know, young medical entrepreneurs out there to take away from this show today, we'd be really, you know, very grateful.
Yeah. I guess I probably touched upon most of those, but maybe helpful to recap as a final parting words. I would say the first one is, never stop in investing in yourself in areas outside of your clinical work. So obviously, as doctors, we're trained to be continuous learners, right? Learning new guidelines, learning new skills, continuing to improve on our clinical skills. But do that also for your non-clinical skills. That could be coding, that could be video editing, that could be photography, that could be playing a musical instrument. Whatever it is that gives you that extra edge that makes you who you are, keep investing the time to develop those skills. Because you never know when they come to be very helpful in whatever you end up doing in the future. The second theme, I guess, the second piece of advice is, don't overthink your plan. Don't overthink your life plan as a doctor. We all do it. We all fall into that trap of overly planning out F1 and F2 and CT1 and CT2 and ST3 and ST4. We already have a detailed plan of how that's going to go and where we're going to train and how we're going to apply for these exams and how we get. It seldom goes to plan. I promise you, it seldom goes to plan. And often what ends up happening is probably better than the plan you thought you had. So realize that there isn't a single straight line or a single path to the final outcome. Do, of course, plan for the final outcome you want to end up in and the destiny you want to end up in. Enjoy the journey, but realize that it's not a single path and there are many paths that lead to that final outcome. And by giving yourself that flexibility to explore different paths, you'll probably be pleasantly surprised with the outcome.
Fantastic. Well, look, it's been a real pleasure having the show today. Thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Hey guys, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. I hope you all enjoyed it. If you did, I'd really appreciate if you could give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter with all the links in the description below. Until next time, thank you so much for listening and take care.